This is She's On Call, a weekly show hosted by ENT specialist Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar and general surgeon Dr. Marina Kurian. They'll be joined by guest experts to discuss an array of newsworthy medical and health issues. You're invited to ask the doctors anything. The physicians and their guests' views are their own and do not represent any institution. Please contact your doctor for any personal questions. Please hit share and join us live on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at She's On Call, hashtag She's On Call. Please welcome our hosts.
Hello, I'm Dr. Sajana Chandrasekhar. I'm an ear, nose, and throat surgeon practicing in New York City and New Jersey.
I'm Marina Kurian, and I'm a general surgeon and a weight loss surgeon in New York City.
Welcome to our 23rd show, All About Your Gut.
That's right. So She's On Call. It's live on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. And if you guys are listening and you're like, you know what? My friend has been having gut problems. Have them, like it, share it to them, tag them so that they can come and listen to the show, because we have two great experts for you guys today. Dr. Lisa Ganju, who is a hepatologist and a gastroenterologist at NYU Grossman School of Medicine and NYU Langone Health. And also Dr. Ali Shulman is going to be joining us. And she is at the University of Michigan. She's an advanced GI, but also a gastroenterologist. We're going to find out the difference on today's show about what those guys do that's the same and that's different. And we're just so excited to have them.
Yeah, we're really excited to speak with them and looking forward to learning a lot, particularly me, because my knowledge of the gut starts at the mouth and sort of ends at the lower neck, whereas Marina, Lisa, and Ali know everything. But before we do that, let's run down some of the news. And unfortunately, Marina, COVID.
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, COVID. So it's still here and it's like on a rampage right now across the world. And the numbers are staggering. There are, 11 million Americans that have it. But across the world, it's actually just much worse than it was. And there are hospital systems that are completely overloaded. And for example, in Naples, the hospitals are so full that they can't accept any patients in. And what they're doing is family members are driving patients up to the hospital parking lot, and people are getting oxygen in their car because there's no space in the hospitals. And this is something that we're concerned about in this country. And you guys may know that in North Dakota, the governor said that if nurses test positive, that they can still come to work, because otherwise they would have a complete shortage of healthcare workers. So they are asking, even if they're positive, to come in. Now, that's an interesting concept, right, Sajana? Because you think, okay, someone's positive, they shouldn't come in to work. But what we found in healthcare is that if you wear your mask appropriately, you practice take all the appropriate measures, that you're not going to give somebody else COVID in the hospital, right?
Right. So the chances of these nurses coming in who are testing positive or sick from COVID, commuting that disease to other people, is quite low, because we all wear N95, we all wear surgical masks, we all wear goggles, we all wear gloves, we all wear our PPE, our personal protective equipment. Unfortunately, this is an illness. So if they are coming to work, they are also not at home and resting and getting better. So as you can imagine, and appropriately so, the nurses, the physicians, the healthcare workers are quite up in arms about this, because North Dakota also does not have a mask mandate or a stay-at-home mandate or any mandate that is curbing the spread of this disease in the community. And we have a little graphic that shows the difference between the cases in North Dakota on August 28th versus the cases in North Dakota yesterday. And you can see that they had a 4% positivity and nobody was in the intensive care unit on August 28th. whereas yesterday their positivity rate was 17%. So when they tested people, 17% were positive for COVID in the back of the nose, which is very contagious. 305 people were currently hospitalized, and their ICUs are running out of space. Their hospitals are running out of space. And as you said, they're running out of healthcare workers. So they're asking people to come in when they're sick, which is the exact opposite. Like 2020 is like opposite day every day, right? We weren't ever supposed to reuse our PPE. We're reusing our PPE. When you're sick, you're supposed to stay home. Now we're saying when you're sick, come in. To tell you what positivity means, in New York City, the mayor, Bill de Blasio, is saying that he's going to close the schools if the positivity rate in the community gets above 3%. So North Dakota is 17% right now.
Yeah. The other issue is everyone's like, well, 305 patients hospitalized. Lots of North Dakota, lots of our states have very rural areas, and those hospitals are not equipped to take care of ICU in many cases. So there were parts of North Dakota, if you went over the different counties, that would show you that they have zero capacity for ICU. So when we say that, you know, some of our states are being overwhelmed and the hospital system is overwhelmed, it's not like what we have in New York City, where we have all these, you know, and in parts of New Jersey, all the metropolitan cities have lots of hospitals and hospital systems, and they all have ICU capacity. But when we get out further into this great country and into, you know, some of the rural parts that we all love to go and visit, there's zero ICU capacity. So that's really the issue, that North Dakota is at capacity for what they're dealing with. And it is important to try and contain this virus if you can. And, you know, some of the data is suggesting that it's even more infectious now than it was before. And it's not that we're testing people and finding positivity. It's just that the virus has mutated to become more infectious. And I think everyone should remember that, you know, you might get it, you may be completely asymptomatic, or you can be like some of our patients that have come in, had the COVID infection in March and are still being completely fatigued and having a lot of, you know, chest pain when they breathe in or other symptoms. And so you have to really be careful. And Thanksgiving's coming, right, Sitch?
Right, right. So we have, I just want to let you know, people are checking in. So Dr. Victor Sanchez, who was our guest last week talking about childhood mental health, says good morning. Deirdre Gruen, who watches us every week, thank you, Deirdre, says good morning, ladies. Who you calling a lady? And Ellen Austin says they have a lot of mask and other mandates, stay-at-home orders in Europe, and we are seeing the cases rise. We are, but this is skyrocketing in places where there are no mandates. So this is really important. It's not just pandemic fatigue. It's not just forgetting to wear your mask when you go outdoors. But as Marina said, Thanksgiving is coming, and this is really the time when Americans love to get together. Marina found an amazing graphic from that sort of infamous 55-person wedding in Maine that was held this August when the weather was warm. 55 yeah. people attended that wedding, and one guest had COVID. And then what happened, Marina?
Well, so you guys can see on the graphic, right? So one person had it. Of those 55 people, which is not a big wedding, that's tiny, you know, by Indian standards.
That's not even a wedding. That's not even a dinner.
And then, so the virus then spread to 176 other people and 7 people died. But the kicker is none of the people who died were at the wedding. So it spreads easily, and you really have to try and minimize the groups and be socially distant, wear a mask as much as you can. And definitely, you know, the hard part is wearing a mask inside when you're in your bubble, right? And that comes up with Thanksgiving, because Thanksgiving is coming. My kids are coming home. I'm excited. But it's going to be a small group. And in New York State, they're saying, the government has said that if you're going to have anything over Thanksgiving or any of the holidays, no more than 10 people. And it's actually, I live in an apartment, and our apartment building is also putting out that thing that you can't have more than 10 people in your apartment. So it's being followed at many different levels. And Yeah, go ahead, Sid, the CDC guidance.
Yeah, so the CDC has really issued guidance that's lots of words. So we broke it down into a graphic that's a little easier to remember. And please take a screen grab if you can. The lower risk activities are small dinners with people who live in your household, shopping online, watching stuff like sports or movies from home. Moderate risk is small outdoor dinner party, pumpkin patches where you use hand sanitizer and wear masks and maintain social distancing. And really high risk activities are if you're shopping in crowded stores, if you're going to, for example, a football game. My friend's son went to a university football game on October 31st, started feeling sick November 4th, lost his sense of smell the following Monday. You know, this is a real disease. And certainly large indoor gatherings with people from outside your household, outside your bubble. So you really want to be cognizant. We are very afraid in healthcare that big Thanksgiving gatherings are going to result in a huge surge of patients who are really sick by around Christmas time. And again, overloading the hospitals that are really, even in places where positivity is relatively low, our hospitals really cannot handle, I mean, we can handle and we will handle, but don't want to handle another surge. So I think
there's the healthcare workers too. I have colleagues who went through the whole thing in March. And actually one of our guests, I think, also went through it in March in the city. And they don't want another surge. I mean, it was just, it's surreal and people were dying and, you know, there's just supportive therapy and all that, but nobody wants another surge. Nobody wants the ICUs full like it was. And it's just, it's not like the healthcare workers have post-traumatic stress disorder, right?
But we kind of do. Yeah, we could ask Victor. I bet we do.
We should introduce our guests. And again, just a reminder for our viewers, obviously you guys are watching us, so you know that we're live on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. But if you have friends that might be interested, we're going to meet our guests now, and you should tag them, like this show, and share amongst your people. And our guests today, again, are Dr. Lisa Ganju. She's a gastroenterologist at NYU Grossman School of Medicine and NYU Langone Health. And Dr. Allie Shulman, who's a gastroenterologist at the University of Michigan. And welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah. We're so excited to have you guys. There's so many things to talk to you about in 48 minutes. So.
So thank you guys so much for joining us. And I have to say, Allie is literally, she's on call today. So thank you for, keep your fingers crossed that she gets to stay with us for the full hour. Today we're going to talk about gastrointestinal health. And for those of you who don't quite get what happens to food when it enters your mouth and before it exits, this is the gastrointestinal tract. And we're going to talk about many of the organ systems that are labeled on this graph, and because each one can go awry in different ways. So let's start talking about some common stuff. Let's talk about acid reflux or gastroesophageal reflux disease. And maybe Lisa, we'll start with you. What is that and who gets it?
So basically gastrointestinal disorders are either overfunctioning or underfunctioning. So with gastroesophageal reflux, there's a loosening of a normal tight junction that is at the lower esophageal, like at the end of the esophagus and at the top of the stomach. And when that muscle is a little lax or a little lazy or gets stimulated or understimulated, it allows for acidity and food products to reflux up into the esophagus. And so you can get food particles, you can get water, you can get acid. Anything that comes up into the esophagus is what's called reflux. And the symptoms classically are that burning sensation that can go as anywhere from the mid-chest to up in your region. So you know where you wind up, you may be seeing some ear, nose, and throat reactions to acid reflux with hoarseness and like a ball in your throat or trouble swallowing. Some of the problems that happen in the lower esophagus is you can get some inflammation and tightening of the lower esophagus or forming a little ring or sometimes the cell lining actually changes into forming what we call Barrett's esophagus, which are considered pre-malignant lesions that can potentially, not everyone, potentially can go on to form esophageal cancer.
So that's when like the acid comes up from the stomach and actually changes the way those cells in the lower esophagus look, right?
Yeah, basically the cells wind up transforming into a different cell line, which are potential cell lines that turn into a cancer. So that's when we do an endoscopy and we take biopsies of that area, we're looking at that cell line to see if there are any cellular changes, because sometimes those actually come up before you see the before you actually have symptoms.
Yeah, here's this. So this kind of gives you a little idea about GERD and who gets it. But you know, the thing is that 30% of people have some heartburn and reflux. Can you just define when do we consider it a real problem? Like if you get heartburn like once a month, is that a problem? I mean, I think there's some metrics around that, right?
Yeah. I mean, It's a variable because it depends on how bad the symptoms actually are. But I usually tell people if you're having it more than 2-3 times a week and it's not going away with antacids and you can't really link it up to something you're eating. Like if you say, oh, when I have a Philly cheesesteak or mac and cheese or a lot of coffee or a lot of alcohol, then we know that's probably related to food as opposed to something functionally that's gone awry. And it could be that it's diet related, because a lot of the foods can lower, can make that muscle a little bit lax. Some of the foods cause increased acidity in the stomach, and that's why it winds up having more, wind up getting more symptoms.
And you know what, Allie, first of all, Lisa and Allie, both of you guys are gastroenterologists. Just explain the difference in kind of your practice, right? Because go ahead, you guys do it, because I otherwise I'm putting words. But you talk about what you guys do.
Allie, do you want to go ahead first?
Sure, I can get started. So I am gastroenterology trained, but my specific interest is interventional or advanced endoscopy. And so I did an additional year of advanced endoscopy, which includes sort of more of the complex gastrointestinal procedures, including ERCP, where we're looking at both the bile ducts and the pancreatic ducts, including endoscopic ultrasound, where we're able to actually go down into the gastrointestinal tract with special types of scopes that have ultrasound probes at the end, through which we're able to see sort of just outside of the lumen of the gastrointestinal tract. And this allows us to take samples of things that traditionally were unreachable by gastroenterologists doing traditional upper endoscopy. And then in addition to that, there's a whole new therapeutic endoscopic ultrasound field, which is becoming more and more exciting, where we're able to actually intervene outside the lumen of the gastrointestinal tract. So when patients develop pancreatitis, they sometimes get these large collections outside of the gastrointestinal tract, and we can now drain those through endoscopic ultrasound. Or in patients with abnormal surgical anatomy, sometimes it requires special types of connections between two locations to be able to do procedures like ERCP or like endoscopic ultrasound, and we're able to do that as well. And then my specific interest and niche is something known as bariatric endoscopy, where I essentially did a full year of training in how to sort of manage complications of prior bariatric surgery endoscopically so that these patients don't need to be taken back to the OR. And also perform primary endoscopic therapy to help treat obesity, but all through the mouth, so no surgical incisions.
And Lisa?
I'm general gastroenterology and hepatology, so I do all the endoscopic procedures that are basically the general GI stuff. So I do endoscopies and colonoscopies. The endoscopies where you're looking inside the esophagus, the stomach, and the small bowel. A colonoscopy is where you're actually looking at the whole large bowel and the portion of the small bowel. I do have extra training in hepatology. So I do practice some hepatology and certification in obesity as well. So all diseases of the gastrointestinal tract, the liver, and with obesity, and not the surgical part where Allie's, and I'm doing more of the medical part of obesity management.
So you guys both, you know, you have overlap I have overlap with you guys, and there's some overlap with Sijna.
There's overlap between Sijna and myself. There definitely is. We see a lot of people with what we call laryngopharyngeal reflux. So the acid has to come from the stomach and kind of visits up at Sijna's region. Most of the time when they're sleeping, that's kind of when the acid reflux is so high up into the upper throat that they wind up getting some hoarseness and some of the symptoms that Sijna is actually managing.
Some of the other more common things that we see our patients have, and sometimes I have gastritis, and I've actually had ulcers. So can we talk a little bit about that, Lisa?
Sure. So basically, ulcers can happen from a bunch of different sources. Then let me go back to what it is. An ulcer is kind of like, and I explain this to my patients, it's basically like if you skin your knee and you get that redness off your knee, that's kind of what gastritis is. Now, if you get a deeper gash and you have a lot of bleeding, then you actually have an ulcer within the stomach. And most common reasons for gastritis and ulcers are the common medications that we take for pain, which would be the NSAIDs, the Advil, the Motrin, aspirin, Aleve. All of those things basically form ulcers by shedding that protective layer on the stomach wall, the stomach lining, and give you increased risk of these ulcers and gastritis. The hyperacidity that happens or when you have increased acid just adds to it as well.
So, you know, I think you talked about people trying to treat themselves with, let's say, over-the-counter antacids. I know that dietary modification is really important. One of my colleagues, Jonathan Aviv, deals with all of this acid reflux in the throat a lot. And, he really preaches a low-acid diet that really helps these people, not just only low-acid, but, you know, avoiding all these foods that are pH less than 4, like bottled, like iced teas, canned sodas, tomato sauce. Not regular tomatoes are fine, but tomato sauce is bad for you. Vinegars are bad for you. But also we talk about, you know, eating several hours before you go to sleep, you know, making sure you walk around, making sure you and allow that food and that acidity to clear the stomach before you lie down for bed, and maybe even using a wedge to get that better, to prevent that acidity. Let's say you do all of this and you see your doctor and you get the treatment and you develop an ulcer. Ali, I was really fascinated by the ability for people like you to over-sew, to cover up that ulcer endoscopically and allow it to heal. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So this is sort of a new, exciting area of our field. There is one FDA-approved endoscopic suturing device on the market, and I think this has really sort of revolutionized what we can do endoscopically. So this device was originally designed to basically close tears or perforations or for tissue apposition. But many of us have sort of extrapolated its use in a variety of different ways. And one in which we do that is to take healthy tissue from areas of the stomach and basically over-sew it over non-healthy or ulcerated tissue. And this is sort of first described in the setting of gastric bypass. So what you can see on the screen here is a large gastrojejunal anastomosis ulceration, which is an ulcer that occurs at the site of that surgical connection following gastric bypass. Typically, as you can see in this picture, typically these occur on the jejunal side or the small bowel side. And so what we can do is take healthy tissue from either the small bowel or the stomach and basically overlay it or over-sew it to the non-healthy tissue. And we've had pretty good results that these really lead to improvement in both symptoms and pain, but also ulcer healing.
You know, I love that you guys are able to do that. I just had a patient that was sent to me because she had ulcers that would come and go and they'd treat them, but then they'd keep coming back. But she was also having, because of the ulcers, some narrowing of the outlet of her stomach. So she basically had what we call gastric outlet syndrome. And I was like, well, you know, if the ulcers keep coming back or if it's a persistent ulcer, I said, we could send it to some of our colleagues that could sew over it. In the end, though, I ended up operating because the patient was like, no more. I've been dealing with this for 3 years. You need to take care of this. So I did end up doing an old-fashioned operation, which we never see anymore because the treatment for ulcers with, you know, proton pump inhibitors, which is a omeprazole, the Prilosec, the Nexium of the world that many people know about. You know, and the thing about ulcer disease, it is absolutely a worldwide phenomenon because and has been around for years. Gastric bypass, which you mentioned, Allie, actually came from ulcer surgery that we've been doing for years, for hundreds of years. So 100 years. And my grandfathers, both of my grandfathers, actually my mom's dad, basically died of a bleeding ulcer. So that was not good, right? But because there were no omeprazoles back then. But my dad's dad, in 1928, had a half of his stomach taken out for ulcers and survived and lived into his 90s. So it's something that's very common and it's still very prevalent to this day. Yeah.
That's amazing. My great-grandfather actually had throat cancer. So maybe genetically we're inclined to just kind of somehow, you know, somewhere in the genes follow something where we could go back in time and help our forebears. I want to point out we have people watching from all over. We have people watching from Nicaragua, from California, from the great borough of Queens. We have people watching from Ohio. You know, we talked about Thanksgiving earlier, and then I want to get back to overall GI. But you guys are terrific doctors. So Ellen Austin says, what if there's a group that's getting together, everybody's being careful, what is the limit? Can six of us, can eight of us get together, I think she said, from different homes for a large indoor gathering? And I'll tell you, The Hill did a study, a survey, and 38% of Americans are planning to either host or attend a large indoor Thanksgiving in 2 weeks. And the guidance from epidemiologists has been, well, if you're going to go somewhere where you haven't been, you should quarantine for 2 weeks, which would have been last Friday, at least 7 to 10 days, which is basically now or tomorrow. So maybe, Allie, I'm going to ask you, what do you tell your patients with this question?
It's a great question. So I think I'm on the particularly conservative end, mainly because my husband ran our COVID unit at University of Michigan. And so he has had to deal with things and see things that I hope many of us will never need to be exposed to. So I tend to tell people that small gatherings with people who with whom you've already been quarantining is appropriate. I worry about people who are even if they're being tested, to go then join other gatherings, because we know from some of our tests that they're not perfect, and that it also can take several days to convert from exposure to a positive test. So I think as conservative as we can be during this holiday time will benefit all of us. Obviously, none of us have ever been exposed to a pandemic or anything like this in the past. And it's, of course, very sad to not be able to spend the holidays with family. But at least for those of us who have been able to be healthy during this period, we should do our best to keep others around us, and especially people who are elderly or immunocompromised, as healthy as possible.
Lisa, you also worked during the pandemic.
Yeah. I did a 4-week rotation on the COVID floors. And, you know, I can't stress enough that they really have to take this seriously. You know, everyone keeps saying, well, we'll have a vaccine. That's all well and fine. But I think what we can do right now is mask, wash your hands, and social distancing. And, you know, it's terrible that we're approaching the holidays and we can't see our families. And, you know, I'm sure everyone's missing it. I know in our family, we're actually doing a Zoom Thanksgiving. I just got my invitation last night for it. So we're all going to be enjoying dinner together separately with our iPads at 7:30. So, you know, we have to do it. We have to protect each other as best we can. So, I can't say it enough.
Something that happens after Thanksgiving and normally, and the overeating, is people get gallbladder attacks. So that's topic of the day.
Okay.
Awesome. That you got fit right into it. It's beautiful. Thank you to our viewer for the question. That's perfect. But can we just talk about the workup of gallbladder disease? What are the symptoms, and then what can be done? And then that'll probably tie into Allie's emergency that she had this morning.
So, Allie, you're up.
Perfect. So, you know, gallbladder pain sort of can refer to a variety of entities. Sometimes it is biliary colic, which is the gallbladder trying to release bile acid to digest food that is passing through the upper part of the small bowel or the duodenum in order to promote basically degradation or digestion of that food. And that can be very painful to people if the bile acids are unable to pass easily through the cystic duct and then into the common bile duct, as you can see on that figure screen right. The other thing that can promote biliary pain would be acute inflammation of the gallbladder, also known as cholecystitis. That can similarly cause pain like biliary colic in many ways. And additionally, if those gallstones tend to migrate down that common bile duct and then get stuck at the bottom, it can cause either pancreatitis because the pancreatic duct takes off right where the bile duct takes off, or it can cause cholangitis or acute infection of the bile duct. And all of those things can sort of lead to pain that we describe as sort of gallbladder pain, which is commonly a gnawing pain in the right upper quadrant. It can sometimes radiate to the back. Sometimes it's more epigastric or centrally located. But what becomes more of an emergency is when those gallstones have passed down the cystic duct and then become blocked in either the common bile duct or blocking the common bile duct and the pancreatic duct. And when patients present with typical pain, usually the treatment would be a gallbladder removal. But when they present with pain that then leads to elevated liver function tests and fevers and elevated inflammatory markers, that becomes more of a medical emergency requiring the special types of procedures that I described earlier, where we basically go into the bile duct and remove the stones that you see. And on that ultrasound image, you can see the gallbladder, which we commonly see through endoscopic ultrasound and through transabdominal ultrasound. And then when you see stones in the gallbladder, like you see in that second image, those can sort of shadow. And then occasionally those stones can migrate down the cystic duct, as I mentioned, and then become stuck in the common bile duct. And we can diagnose and see those as well.
So when you talk about ERCP, which is endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography.
That was impressive.
I'm like, oh, that was from 1984 medical school, right? So when you talk about that, can you talk about that? Because, you know,
yeah.
So back in the day, removing your gallbladder meant an incision from here to here. You know, my job as a medical student was to hold the liver back with this huge, giant retractor called a sweetheart, right? Like the Harrington retractor, while the surgeon went and dug in there and got that inflamed gallbladder out. And that's gone to, you know, endoscopic surgery where the incisions are much smaller. And then, as you said, maybe procedures where you don't need an incision at all.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So an endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography, also known as ERCP, is a procedure where we go down through the mouth, through the esophagus, through the stomach, and then into the upper part of the small bowel. But unlike traditional upper endoscopy, we're using a special kind of scope that actually looks to the side. So it looks 90 degrees opposite where you think you're going, which explains partially why an additional year of training is required to be able to do these procedures. And through this special kind of scope, we're actually able to access the bile duct. And so in the upper portion of the duodenum, there's a structure known as the ampulla. And that is where...
I'm going to stop you for just 1 second. Can you explain what the duodenum is?
Absolutely. So that is the first portion of the small bowel. So the small bowel is about 15 feet long, and the first portion of it is known as the duodenum. And it's a very important part of anatomy because it's where a lot of the hormone regulation and a lot of substances are secreted. But it's also very important because the bile duct and the pancreatic duct terminate at a location known as the ampulla, which is located in the second of four portions of the duodenum. And so we are able to pass our scope down to the level of the ampulla, And then we look for the biliary orifice, which is where the bile duct is terminating, which is usually somewhat distinct from the pancreatic orifice, which is where the pancreatic duct is terminating. And our goal during this procedure, especially when we're doing it for in the setting of a gallstone that needs to be removed, is to pass our instruments up into the bile duct. Usually that entails first a wire, and then over that wire, we pass an instrument known as a sphincter tome. And that allows us, as you mentioned, to make a little cut at the bottom of the bile duct through which we're able to sweep out the stones that we see in the bile duct that may be causing obstruction.
That's amazing. I think I want to talk about some other stuff, but I want to answer some audience questions. Mm-hmm. So we have two questions. Vandana Menon says, how can you tell if an ulcer is developing? And Chris Ramanathan, my husband, says, are there specific spices that are known to cause or exacerbate heartburn or reflux? And maybe I'll start with you, Lisa, and then Ali weigh in.
Sure. So with that last question, there is some thought that cayenne or chili peppers may increase acidity in the stomach. So that's why sometimes people can't eat spicy food because it increases their reflux. You know, a lot of activity, stress can also worsen reflux as well. Minding what bothers your stomach should kind of guide you into what kind of changes you should make within your diet. I mean, not everyone has those symptoms. So, you have to be mindful about what triggers your symptoms and maybe thinking back when you do have some discomfort, looking back to what is it, something I ate or something I did, or if I drank too much or ate too much. So that would be my advice as far as food related to reflux.
And then the other one was ulcer. Like, how can you tell you're having an ulcer?
Right. So the ulcer question, sure. So basically the alarm for having an ulcer would be if you have black stools. And when we talk about black stools, we're talking about black tar-like stool that has a very pungent odor to it. And that's what that is digested blood. And if you have this frequent bowel movements with that black tarry stools, you just really have to head over to the emergency room because it looks like or sounds like that's a bleeding ulcer. People will have extreme pain, pain that's kind of unrelenting. Those are the types of things. But I think the hallmark is the black stools.
And that's for a bleeding ulcer. I'll tell you, when I had my ulcers, which, you know, given my family history, is anybody surprised that I had ulcers? I was like, okay, my gastroenterologist is like, you take a lot of Advil. I'm like, I do not. I take it back then I was like, maybe once a month I would take, you know, two or three Advil. Like, I don't take it a lot. But I had pain under my left rib cage, and I would just be like, I'd operate, I'd get done, I'd go see a patient, I'd be holding my side. I'm like, God, my stomach really hurts. And my colleague at the time is like, you think you might have an ulcer or something? I'm like, I don't know. And so they used to have all these stories like, you know, if you drink milk and the pain goes away, then you have a stomach ulcer, right? Is that still a thing? Like, if food makes the pain better, because it did. But the other part was like, when I was a chief resident, I would do my rounds and I would stop at every like nurse's cart and have a cup of coffee. I'd stop at every nurse's cart and take like a swig of, oh God, like Maalox or something like that. And they were like, don't you think you should put your coffee down? I'm like, I'm on rounds. Like, we have to keep going. So, doctors may not be the best patients. Here I am. But is that true though? You eat with a pain from an ulcer that it'll get better? Is that like a cue?
Yeah, I think that is because it kind of buffers the ulcer a little bit. Just like anything just kind of coats it to help kind of soothe it, I guess. And, you know, as doctors, like you were saying, you power through it. Try not to power through these things and, you know, make sure you go see your primary care doctor, your gastroenterologist, just to get that evaluated. An endoscopy would be the way to go with someone who's got pain around like what you're saying. Ulcers are treatable with medications. You had mentioned this earlier that we're not seeing that many ulcer surgeries anymore because we're seeing people use more of those acid reducing medications that we can get over the counter. A lot of the medicines that we used to do, or a lot of the medications we used to be prescribe now are over the counter. So that's a, we're seeing less of it unless they get really bad. And if it, that just doesn't cut it, that's when people are coming to see their doctors.
Lisa, let's talk a little bit about irritable bowel and inflammatory bowel, and then we'll have Allie weigh in on that.
Sure. So unfortunately, they have very similar letters.
Yeah. So, for years, I was like IBS, IBD, I don't know. Yeah.
There's like total spectrum of diseases. So IBS is irritable bowel syndrome. It's fairly common, and it's related to the motion of the gastrointestinal tract and hypersensitivity. So basically, you've got a very sensitive gut, so things tend to cause more pain, more spasm with the motility or the motion of the colon. If you've got a very slow colon, people tend to have what we call IBS-C or IBS constipation. People who have a very rapid GI tract, they tend to have IBS-D, which is IBS diarrhea responsive. So depending on the stressors or food, anxiety, people with irritable bowel syndrome can get triggered and have these flares or their symptoms. As opposed to IBD, which is inflammatory bowel disease, which is an inflammatory process. And the two main ones that we have are Crohn's disease, which affects the whole digestive tract from mouth to butt, and ulcerative colitis, which just basically stays within the colon. And those are inflammatory conditions where you can get ulcerations, sloughing off of the skin of, or sorry, the layer, the mucosal layer of the inside of the colon. And you wind up getting diarrhea, bloody stools, mucoid stools, pain. So they may present somewhat similar, but not similar. And they're very totally different pathology and totally different management. With irritable bowel syndrome, it's mostly trigger management, meaning avoiding the things that trigger it. Symptom management, like antidiarrheals, antibiotics for diarrhea, stool softeners and fiber for constipation part of IBS. For IBD or inflammatory bowel disease, it's more anti-inflammatory medications like the sulfasalazines, some of the biologics, like you'll see the commercial for like Remicade or Humira. All of those basically act on the body's inflammatory process to kind of lower your immunity so that your body can heal. But they're very totally different presentations, totally different outcomes and complications.
I feel like on both of those slides though, probiotics is sort of important. Like for, can we talk about it, Allie, you too? Like, you know, do we, probiotics and who should take them? I actually have my patients when they come in with different complaints, I'm like, okay, you should take this probiotic, you should take this one. And I get that from you guys because they'll come back or one of my GI colleagues will be like, hey, so, you know, I saw so-and-so and I put them on this probiotic. And I was like, note to self, remember that. So the next time my patient complains about something, I think they would try this. So let's talk a little bit about probiotics and who gets them and when it's a good idea and specifics also to irritable bowel syndrome or inflammatory bowel disease.
Sure. So I'm a big proponent of probiotics only if you need them. That's my whole thing. If your gut is happy and you don't pay attention to your digestive tract, you don't need any probiotics because your own microbiome is doing its job. It's working well, it's in balance, there's nothing you need to tweak. It's when you start having kind of the pain or the change in your bowel habits or something's just off, especially after antibiotics or travel, a night of heavy drinking, anything that might shift that healthy microbiome, those are the ones that need probiotics. And you're right, there's several strains of probiotics. Most of the digestive type ones are either the Bacteroides or the Lactobacillus family. I tend to avoid telling patients or pulling people back off of probiotics if they're on the ones that have too many strains of probiotics, because I think that just kind of makes things worse. And keeping things simple, like either one organism or no more than 4 to 5 to just kind of help them over the hump. But don't rely on it too much. If you do have a lot of new symptoms, definitely see your doctor as well. But those are, you know, I think the probiotics are relatively new to Western medicine. You know, the integrative folks have been using it for years on like the Ayurvedic or the more Western or Eastern medicine type things. I remember grandmothers and moms saying, if your stomach's upset, go drink some yogurt. Who knew? They were telling us to go take some probiotics. But yeah, yogurt also, which is a natural probiotic, definitely helps with digestion.
So I really like that point of don't take every single probiotic on the shelf, right? Limit it from 1 to 4, which is really important. So Allie, we've had surgeons on, like Marina, talking about gastric bypass, talking about gastric sleeve, various surgical interventions for obesity. And I know that gastroenterologists like you are doing endoscopic interventions. So could you talk to us a little bit about some non-open surgical options for obesity?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is one of the newer, more exciting areas of our field because it has now allowed us to help treat obesity for patients who may not otherwise be candidates for bariatric surgery. Either their BMI is too low, so they wouldn't qualify or get insurance coverage, or patients who are just terribly afraid of undergoing a procedure and they see bariatric surgery as too invasive for them. And so this has been a really exciting area that we have sort of been at the forefront of in regard to bariatric endoscopists. And so what we are able to do now is either place a variety of sort of intragastric devices that are now approved for weight loss, or use that same platform that I discussed earlier to create an endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty, which we'll talk about in just a minute. So the first picture that you saw up there was an intragastric balloon. There's currently 3 intragastric balloons that are FDA approved on the market. There's 2 more that look pretty exciting that may be approved in the near future. The one that you're seeing there is sort of a single chamber balloon. It's filled with about 500 to 700 cc's of fluid. It's easily placed. These are very straightforward, simple procedures that require training and expertise, but they're very straightforward once you have that training. And so we basically do an upper endoscopy, pass that intragastric balloon, which is contained within a catheter alongside your scope, and then release it in the stomach after filling it with the volume that I mentioned previously. And these balloons stay in 6 months and then they need to come out. And so they're, but during that 6 months, they serve as sort of a filling device for the stomach. And there's also other mechanisms that are involved in weight loss, including hormonal changes and other things that occur. But the main idea is that it's sort of an intragastric device that takes up volume. The other procedure.
How does that balloon not migrate down and block the outflow tract of the stomach? Like when I'm looking at that picture, how does it not then cause a problem? I told you I'm going to ask stupid questions.
No, it's not a stupid question. It's a great question.
These are fantastic questions. So the balloon itself is filled to a volume, on average, about 600 milliliters of fluid, which is way larger than what would allow passage through the stomach, through the pylorus, into the small bowel, which we had discussed earlier. So generally, these are pretty safe. They stay in the stomach. They fill a large volume, and they do not migrate. There's always, case reports and very few patients who develop that complication where the balloon will deflate and then somehow pass and get stuck in the small bowel, but it's very, very rare. So I think the best, these balloons really fill a void for patients who are either too scared to undergo any permanent change to their stomach in any way, whether that be surgical or endoscopic, or they require some sort of bridge to another procedure, whether that be a knee replacement, a heart transplant, a kidney transplant. This can help you sort of lose the necessary amount of weight to be listed for those procedures or to be considered a candidate for those procedures.
And also we have to say though that it is an FDA approved device and it was approved for certain weight class. Mm-hmm. Or body mass index of 30 to below 40 because, but some of what Allie was talking about, we do offer the balloon to people who are outside of that range, and we consider that an off-label use of the device. But we have offered it in those cases to try and get the patient's weight down. And as Allie said, it's true. There's, we currently offer weight loss surgery to patients, and of all the eligible patients, you know, there are probably about 18 million people who qualify for weight loss surgery in the U.S. alone, and we take care of about 250,000 of them. So there's a lot of people who are maybe concerned about the surgery, as you mentioned, afraid to reach out, don't realize they have a problem, and, you know, sometimes looking at these endoscopic treatments is more of a prevention, because you're going to prevent them from getting to that higher weight class where they qualify for surgery. And the balloon therapy on average, you know, I was quoted to my patients when I offered it that it was 20 to 40 pounds and the average would be about 30, right? So the range was 20 to 40. And we've all seen patients who've had these balloons lose less than the 20 and then also lose more, you know, that some people would lose like 70 pounds. But the thing about the device, it is short term, and then you have to remove it, and then hopefully we have patients on medications and in a program where they can help maintain that weight off. But let's talk about endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty. That's the other one, Allie.
Yeah, so this has by far in my own practice been the most popular procedure that we offer. And interestingly, since all of COVID has been ongoing, our enrollment for this has probably gone up by over 300%. And so I think with the, you know, the association between obesity and worse outcomes when you develop COVID, maybe that has prompted some of this, or maybe it's just, you know, that people are in quarantine and they're not as healthy as they're able to be because their gyms are closed, or they aren't able to eat the food that they normally like to eat. So the endoscopic sleeve gastroplasty is a procedure in which we go down with an endoscopic suturing device and basically imbricate or suture the entire greater curvature of the stomach. So we reduce the gastric volume by about 70%. And after the procedure, patients are enrolled, as Marina mentioned, and this is exceedingly important. I work very closely with our surgical service, very closely with our endocrinology service. And so patients who enroll in this program are entitled to a full year's worth of therapy, which include 12 nutrition visits, 6 provider visits, 3 behavioral psychology visits. Oftentimes, if depending on their weight, when I see them, I will refer them to our surgical colleagues to just hear what they have to say first, because I, you know, sometimes surgery may be a better option for people with very large or very high BMIs. But the endoscopic sleeve, the procedure takes me about an hour. And what it essentially is, it's done under general anesthesia, and we endoscopically suture or imbricate, as I mentioned, the entire greater curvature of the stomach. I tend to leave the top portion of the stomach, known as the fundus, alone, because it's sort of the higher risk area for intervention. It's very thin-walled, and the very few reports of adverse events tend to be focused on this area. And we also think that if you create a little fundic pouch, then maybe food will sort of fill that and trigger changes in hormones that provide even more weight loss to sort of note to you that you are satiated or increase your satiety after a meal.
If you put up that picture of the ESG again, basically, or actually before you do it, because I talk with my hands, you know, the stomach has a nice curve to it, and what we're doing is kind of pleating it in so it folds in on itself. So just pop up that picture so you guys can see that's what's happening. So the volume of the stomach is decreased with the sutures. And let's talk a little bit about the weight loss that you can get from that, but also the durability, right? That's also one of the things that we're all interested in.
Yeah, so both of those are great questions. So the 2-year retrospective study with 3 different centers sort of looking back at 250 total patients showed that at 2 years, the average weight loss was somewhere around 18.7% total body weight loss. So patients were maintaining about a 20% total body weight loss at 2 years. We also have just, one of my colleagues at Cornell has just published 5-year data that show some at 5 years, about 2/3 of patients have maintained somewhere around 15 or 16% total body weight loss. So what I tell all of my patients is that just like potentially some surgical interventions, these may not be durable for everyone, but many patients do experience durability. The nice thing about this procedure is that it's very easy to also go in and repeat because it's all done through the mouth. We're not worried about adhesions that may form, and we can do this relatively quickly for people whose stomach may expand beyond what we had initially intended. So while you know, we're not entirely sure of longer term durability than that 5-year mark, we do know that there's the option for repeating this procedure, which is exciting.
We have great questions from our viewers. I want to thank our viewers. And again, you guys, if you like this, you can also rewatch this on YouTube, LinkedIn, and Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. And also you can rehear the show on WBAI, which is 99.5 FM. Suji, we had a question though from one of our viewers, a great one.
Yeah, so Nina Yashbi from California says, what about the association between proton pump inhibitors or PPI and dementia or mental status? How long do you advise people to stay on them? Did you change when that sort of warning came out? Maybe I'll address this to Lisa.
Sure. Yeah, the there was a lot of press on the complications of PPI use. And, you know, we have to take a lot of those studies with a grain of salt because we don't want to not pay attention to it and or not take people who need to be on the PPIs off of it. So basically, you know, a lot of people were taking the PPIs so that they could maintain their diet on healthy eating. So those are the people that I was basically weeding out. I'm like, listen, you know, how about if we work, if you don't want to be on this medication, then you need to lose weight and you need to change your diet and you need to do all these lifestyle management to try to get yourself off of it. Because I don't want people on medicine if they don't have to be on medicine. Now, if they have Barrett's esophagus or what I was talking about, that acid reflux that causes a burn or ulcers, or if they have something called Zollinger-Ellison where they have to keep their pH of their stomach low and they have to be on the PPIs, then they have to be on it and they need to be monitored on it. Now, as far as the neurologic deficits and all the other changes, the thought is that it could be because it influences the B12, absorption of B12 within the stomach. The thought is that it does decrease some absorption of some nutrients that could down the line cause some neurologic problems, but PPIs in general have been in and used for almost 30 years. And there's a lot of people that were on it for a long time that didn't have those complications. So it's basically just keeping people who need to be on it purposefully. And then just monitoring. There's some people that will monitor magnesium levels or calcium levels or B12 levels while they're on it, but there isn't any real guidelines on that. And just, you know, be wary of potential complications. But again, if you need to be on it, you need to be on it. If you can change by not being on PPIs and perhaps using what we call the H2 blockers, which would be commonly known as like the Pepcid or Famotidine products, that reduces.
Not Zantac. That's what you're saying.
I wasn't going to say
from China.
Zantac, actually, Zantac was taken off the market because of some additive. The drug itself wasn't bad. It was the additive that was in the medication, but those types of medications, yes, I'm using a little bit more of that. When I started my training, that's what we used to use predominantly, and then the PPIs came in, and then we just kind of forgot about this class because you got instant relief as soon as you took those PPIs. And people didn't want that kind of slow heal; they wanted it quick and they wanted it done. But those medications are great and they have less side effects that we're worried about with the PPIs.
And as you're saying, this is not take your PPI, take your Pepcid and then go eat a chili dog, right?
This is, there's a commercial for it. Like I would cringe every time I saw them put it on. Like they're like having their big
fried Oreos,
and you can have your whatever you want to eat.
Unfortunately, we are almost out of time. As we predicted, Marina, our two guests are amazing and full of knowledge. I know there's a lot of questions on the Facebook and Twitter feed, and hopefully our guests will be able to go back later and give you guys some answers to those questions as they feel comfortable. But maybe, Ali, before we say goodbye, can you leave us with a couple of takeaways of something maybe that's coming up, something important that you'd like our viewers to take with them?
Yeah, great question. So I think, thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor and pleasure to be with both of you, with all of you. I think one thing that is probably most exciting is sort of where the field of primary intervention for obesity is moving. And I think there's a lot of exciting devices that are either under investigation or with the FDA currently to help treat obesity in sort of a minimally invasive way. The one thing that I always stress is that it's so important to do this in collaboration with your surgical services and to make sure that that you work very collegially and collaboratively. I am so blessed at University of Michigan to have such a wonderful team of people to work with. And we've really built a program that is comprehensive and multidisciplinary so that we think about a patient and what is individually best for that patient. So I think there's a lot of new and exciting things coming down the pipeline. And I hope in a year or so, we'll be able to discuss even newer and more exciting options.
Lisa, you have any final thoughts before we have to
wrap this up? Sure. Basically, if you have reflux and it's not well controlled and you have any of those alarm symptoms, go to your gastroenterologist to make sure you're not developing any long-term complications. If you're over 45, make sure you talk to your doctor about getting your scheduled for your colonoscopy or some sort of colon cancer screening. And third and most important, try to keep a healthy weight, keep a healthy gut and a healthy liver. And, you know, stay healthy, happy, and eat well.
Thank you both so much for joining us. Our guests today were Dr. Ali Shulman from University of Michigan Medical Center and Dr. Lisa Ganju from NYU Medical Center. We really appreciate all your wisdom and advice that you shared with us today. And next week, Marina, our pre-Thanksgiving show.
Yeah. So, okay. First, we want to thank our team. We can't do this show without our great producers. And we want to thank them heartily. And also, you can see us again on Twitter. So you can rewatch this on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. And also, we're going to be played again on WBAI, which is 99.5 FM. And next week's show is going to be with Dr. Richard Webby, who is a virologist with the WHO, and also Dr. Aditya Shah, who is also a Twitterati. He's Dr. Adi, has the best video tweets ever. I don't know where he finds them, but we're so excited to have both of them. And with that, we're going to close today's show. Thank you so much for watching.
Stay safe, everyone. Mask up.